Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. We're going to be talking today with people from Connecticut, and they're going to bring us up to date in terms of a major court ruling that came down rather recently and what it means, both for the state of Connecticut and possibly for the rest of the country. To start off with, we have a person who's new to the War Report, and we're going to start with her. Her name is Wendy Lacker. Hi, Wendy, and welcome to the War Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
See how concise she is? No wasted words here. Wendy, this is the War Report. We have at it here, so hopefully feel right at home, let it all go, and, you know, keep that professionalism, yes, but I don't. Well, I won't say anymore. Next, Jonathan, you are a person who's been on the War Report a couple of times. Welcome back. Been a while.
It's an honor to be back on the show, and we really appreciate you taking a look at these developments here in the state of Connecticut.
Wendy, very quickly, give us a short bio of this, on you.
Oh, well, I am a senior attorney at the Education Law Center, which is located in Newark, New Jersey, which, if you remember or if you've ever heard of the landmark New Jersey school funding case, Abbott v. Burke, they are the ones who brought that case, and they work on various issues across the country, both in New Jersey and across the country, on school equity and school funding issues. I cover New York for them. I do my work in New York. But I also happen to live in Connecticut. I'm a public school parent in Connecticut for the past 17 years. And I also write a column on education policy in Connecticut. So I'm invested in many ways in what goes on in Connecticut public schools.
I am aware of Wendy and her work in the educational organization she works with, and as I told her not too long ago, I am a huge fan of her organization and herself. I've followed her work for the last two and a half years, and I've wanted her to be on the show for that length of time, and I finally got an opportunity to get her on the show. Folks, she is terrific, and I hope to have her back many, many times in the future. Okay. First of all, the case. Let's give the name of the case and some background leading up to the filing itself and what the primary issue is. As I understand it, and Wendy, this comes from one of your recent posts, that raised the question, will equity without adequacy be enough to help Connecticut's neediest children? Mm-hmm. Was that the gist of the suit?
The gist of the suit was actually, this suit was filed, and by the way, the name of this suit is called CJEF v. REL. CJEF is shorthand for the Connecticut Coalition of Justice in Education Funding. It was a coalition of parents and municipalities, but especially the parents were the plaintiffs. These are parents from Connecticut's poorest districts. The case was filed back in 2005. It was a very long road to get to trial in 2015, but the coalition, made up mainly of parents and community members in these poorest districts, they sued because they saw that performance was really lagging in their schools. Their children were not graduating at rates that were acceptable. Their test scores were not at rates that are acceptable. And they also knew that their schools were under-resourced, severely deficient in essential educational resources, and they could not locally, because their districts were poor, couldn't raise the money locally. They were not getting enough money from the state, and so they sued the state, saying that the state is, by failing to fund their schools adequately, is violating their constitutional right under the Connecticut Constitution for an education. Now, to give
Go ahead.
Well, it took that long because the state tried to dismiss the case, and it was dismissed, but then the plaintiffs appealed it, and back in 2010, our highest court, the Connecticut Supreme Court, said that, no, these children have a right to go to trial and prove whether there are adequate resources in their schools. It would be a violation, while we give great deference to the legislature in matters of education, if they're violating the Constitution. That's something that a court should be adjudicating. And so that's why it got to go to court. And there were a lot of procedural issues leading up. So between 2010 and 2015, it took a while to get to trial, but it finally did. I think it's important, in order to understand what happened in the CJEF case, it's very important to understand what goes on nationally. This is not the only case that has been brought of this type. All across the country, state constitutions have a clause in their constitution establishing a right to a free public education. And these kind of cases have been brought all across the country. They're called school funding cases. Sometimes they're called adequacy cases because there's inadequate state funding. And what most of these cases have resulted in plaintiff victories. That means the state has been found to violate the Constitution. What courts have found, they've taken a look at the evidence, real evidence of what goes on in the schools, what schools have, and they've noticed that there's a resource gap in these schools, and the resource gap is one of the causes of the achievement gap, that kids don't do well because schools do not have essential resources to help them learn. And really, it's very remarkable that even though these cases are all across the country, Kansas, North Carolina, Wyoming, all across the country, they come up with a consistent basket of goods that they need, and New York too, they see are the essential elements of an adequate education. Small class size in the early years, qualified teachers and a sufficient number of teachers and staff, extra support for kids who need it, because there are some children who need extra, at-risk kids need extra both academic and social support to be able to access the same kind of learning. Extra adequate services with children with extraordinary needs, like special education or English language learners. Adequate facilities. Adequate what's called instrumentalities of learning, like books and computers and desks. A safe and orderly environment. A breadth of a curriculum. And some courts even say pre-K is very important, which we all know is important, but courts have been lagging in recognizing that. So those are the sum of the resources that every court has found is necessary. So getting back to Connecticut, go ahead.
No, you finish.
Okay, well, getting back to Connecticut, this is what the kind of evidence that these districts brought forth. They came, parents, superintendents, teachers came and testified, and they said, you know, we have high needs in our districts. Children come not learning English. Children come with trauma of living in poverty, that they can't put aside that trauma to really focus on learning. Sometimes they come without not having eaten, not having the proper clothing. They miss school because they can't get to school. And we have such high needs that we need small class size, and we don't have that. We have classes extraordinary large classes, especially in the early years. We don't even have enough teachers that we could provide academic intervention in the form of after school or before school or pull out services. We don't have enough teachers, enough staff to provide that so kids can catch up. We don't have pre-K for many of our children, and it's proven that pre-K works. We don't have social workers or guidance counselors, so our kids can't even get their basics needs taken care of so that they can focus on school. We don't have enough English language learner teachers. These are the kinds of resources that these people from these schools, the witnesses, talked about. The trial went over several months, and the court after back on September 7th, after several months of trial, made sweeping findings both on the funding issue, and he even went beyond funding to make all sorts of findings on education policy. So if you want, I can just talk quickly about the funding because it's very crucial, and then just briefly about the education policy. But if you have any questions up to then, I'm happy to take them.
Let's save those 2 points and go to Jonathan, and we'll come back.
Sure.
So what one of the things that it's important to understand is that many of these responsibilities rest with our elected officials. They're the ones that have the constitutional duty to provide adequate education to all of the children of that state. And as Wendy said, because every state constitution requires that there be a free and available, and in most cases, obviously that means a quality education available to all children, that's the duty of state government, and particularly the duty of the chief elected official, the governor, and the state legislators to provide. And because in so many states, the elected officials are not performing their function correctly, they're not providing adequate resources, they're engaged in the corporate education reform, the privatization of public schools, the rise of charter schools, the over-reliance on testing, the Common Core and the Common Core testing scheme that goes along with it, that more and more school districts don't have the resources that they need. And so underlying what Wendy has talked about is the fact that advocates and parents and others who believe in public education are left with no choice but to then go to the judicial branch to seek a remedy, in essence to have the judicial branch step up and try to force the legislative and executive branches to do their jobs. And so we had that situation in Connecticut where this lawsuit was filed in 2005. It's taken 11 years for it to make it through the court system. And in fact, during that time period, we've had Republican and Democratic governors. We've had a Democratic legislature the entire time. And as Wendy will describe the case, and the outcome, but what the bottom line was that the court recognized that the system of funding is irrational and unconstitutional. And that's a condemnation in this state of Democrats. It's a condemnation in New York of Democrats and Republicans, since their legislative branch is split. Same in New Jersey. That what we've seen is that there has been a bipartisan war on public education, and the only way to fight back in so many cases has been to actually go to court. And that is likely to continue to be the case as long as legislators and governors are unwilling to do their constitutional duty on behalf of the children of the country.
Wendy, you had 2 points that you wanted to make.
Yes, well said, Jonathan, by the way. Funding, as I said, the court issued a sweeping decision, and let me just address the funding decision, because that's why these plaintiffs sued. Jonathan said, the court did say that the funding system was irrational, and it was, there are two Connecticuts, and it was inequitable, and we have to calibrate the funding system according to student need. And all of this sounds really wonderful, and the New York Times and many media outlets made a huge deal out of this, that it was indeed a condemnation of the two Connecticuts. But unfortunately, when you actually look at this decision, it's really just hot air. What the court first and most importantly decided is that this one trial judge decided to redefine adequacy. As I explained before, adequacy across the country is getting enough resources to serve all kids no matter what their needs. So, kids who are English language learners, kids with disabilities, kids who might be living in poverty, kids in concentrated poverty. The courts, as I described, that sort of basket of goods of small class size, of social workers, of adequate extra services for kids who need it, all that rich basket of goods was defined by other courts as being the minimum. That's what you need. That's what is the minimum to really provide an adequate education to all children. This judge That's what adequacy means across the country. This judge completely redefined adequacy to be a very narrow thing. He said it's enough. Connecticut's already funding well above because these kids on average have the bare minimum of facilities, meaning buildings, instrumentalities of learning. And he said, yeah, some kids don't even have access to computers, but on the whole, they have bare minimum of instrumentalities and teaching. So he only looked at that. And in fact, he specifically called interventions for at-risk students, like before-school programs, after-school programs, quote, extras. And he said the fact that Connecticut even pays for some of those, I'm not even going to look at whether it's enough because that shows that Connecticut's spending even more than the minimum. So what he did was define adequacy as a very bare minimum that no other court has defined. So when you look, he did say, but we need to, the system, even though they're giving enough, it's inequitably distributed. And it really has to calibrate according to student need. And that's a very important notion, student need, when it comes to designing funding formulas or funding systems in different states. Because when you talk about the needs that a student has, you're really talking about how much more expensive a student is to educate than another student with no additional needs. What kind of extra services does a child living in poverty need? And that is the way, what a state does in establishing a school funding system is to look at not only the number of kids in a particular district, but what kind of needs they have and how much those needs cost. So if a kid is learning English needs extra services in terms of English language learners, that can cost almost twice as much as a kid with no needs. And if a kid is living in poverty and needs a whole host of compensatory education services as well as social intervention, that will cost more. And courts have cost studies have shown that it costs up to two times as much to educate a kid in poverty. So while this judge said, oh, we need something calibrated to student need, he rejected the notion that any kid needs those additional services that make them cost more. He said all those are extras, and the state doesn't need to provide it. So even though he claims to say you have to calibrate funding according to need, he effectively rendered it impossible for a state funding system in Connecticut to look at need because he said those extra services aren't necessary. So it really boils down to a lot of hot air, his equity finding, because if the state isn't required to pay more for kids who cost more, there is no calibration of funding to need.
In this case, the judge is a former legislator, actually was a fairly conservative Democrat, and we're seeing the same this concept that you need to defer to the legislative branch of government. And it's true that the founding fathers of the country wanted a system in which the legislative branch was the preeminent setter of passing the laws, the executive branch implemented those laws, the judicial branch reviewed those laws to make sure that they were constitutional. But of course, as we all know, there was a system of checks and balances that were put in as well, this brilliant mechanism to make sure that no one branch is too strong, nor one branch too weak. And so traditionally, what the courts have done is they've said, yes, the executive and legislative branch should set policy and implement that policy, but it is the judiciary's responsibility to make sure that it's being done correctly. The way that the mass media reported this case was that the judge had taken some dramatic step of saying that Connecticut's funding system was wrong. And there was a piece of truth to that. He said that the money that is being sent out to the cities and towns needs to be done in a fairer way. That is, instead of the wealthy towns getting money, that money should go to the poorer towns. But because he said the total amount of money that's being spent is adequate in his mind, what it's left with is the question of, does enough money get, quote-unquote, wasted on the wealthy towns? And while we would say that wealthy towns should have less state aid and poorer towns should have more state aid. All of the evidence is that Connecticut puts in maybe half of the amount of money that it should in order to provide for adequate education. That is, they would need to double the amount of money in order to give all towns the ability to provide all children. And Connecticut's constitution is very clear that every child deserves an education that prepares them not only for work, but to serve on juries and to live fulfilling lives. Connecticut's constitution, that language is from the standpoint of parents, one of the best in the country in describing not only do children deserve to have an education, they deserve to have a quality education. And so one of the reasons that it was so important that this case be appealed, and it's now been appealed to the state Supreme Court, and now the question is, will the state Supreme Court step up and fulfill its constitutional responsibility of saying the judge was right that the way the money is distributed is wrong and unconstitutional, but the judge was wrong in determining that these things that Wendy has so eloquently described are extras, that special education is not an extra, that English language learning is not an extra, that guidance counselors are not extra, that providing students with a comprehensive education is not extra. Wendy has written a number of columns about this and about how the judge went about defining education so narrowly that conservatives, liberals, people in the middle, there's virtually nobody who would agree that the judge's definition of what is needed for education is, in fact, an appropriate description of what it is. And maybe Wendy could describe the second part of his ruling, which is perhaps even more troubling than the financial part of it.
Or just as troubling.
Wendy, that's your key.
That's just as troubling. So as Jonathan said, not only did he issue this ruling on funding, which was very disappointing, but he also went well beyond what his authority and obviously his knowledge is and made some really troubling decisions on education policy. He decided that the state needs to redefine all its standards for elementary school and for high school and for teacher evaluation and for special education. So on elementary education, he said that, you know, he recognized that problems in high school really start early in elementary school. He actually recognized that problems start even earlier and that preschool is the best weapon to fight some of these gaps that we see among disadvantaged children and their more advantaged peers. But he refused to hold that pre-K was an essential element of education. He wasn't going to order the state to pay for pre-K. But anyway, with regard, his fix for these gaps is to define an elementary education as primarily related to acquiring basic numeracy and literacy skills. And he went even further and said he had a great suggestion for how this kind of definition could, quote, gain heft. He said it might gain heft if, let me back up one second. He said that these standards that they define as basic numeracy and literacy must be verifiable and have substantial consequences, really meaning an elementary school exit exam, a standardized one because he had no patience for local assessments. But what he said is that this kind of standard would gain heft if a kid doesn't leave third grade knowing how to read, perhaps all schools should stop for that kid except learning to read. And learning to read should be the only focus of these children. And in eighth grade, they will test them and make sure that they've met the mark. So can you imagine that a child would go to school because a child could not read at a proper level that defined by a standardized test after third grade, that child would no longer have social studies, science, field trips, which is just not only cruel and ridiculous, but, you know, it harms children both developmentally and even it's a horrible way to teach reading. It harms children developmentally because children are not just reading machines. Children are whole beings. So they need physical, there's no distinction in the brain among social, cognitive, and physical functions. They all need to be developed all at once. You can't neglect one side of a child to develop just one little narrow part. So, and we know that children who are low income don't have the access to all those museums and trips and experiences, music and experiences outside of school that more affluent children have. So this judge says, no, they don't get those experiences. They get just to focus on learning how to read, which would, of course, leave them behind developmentally in every other aspect of their life. It is not even a good way to learn how to read. It's actually a bad way, because most reading specialists understand that kids, the more experiences kids have, the more they can associate words with their experiences, and they can become better readers. So it's a horrible prescription for education in general. It's a particularly horrible prescription for reading, which is what he thought he was getting at. So that's elementary school. For high school, he essentially ordered them to define high school. He looked at, and we could, Jonathan could talk about this a little if he wants, but he looked at the gap between SAT scores, which we all know don't measure, certainly they don't measure Connecticut high school standards, but they don't really measure much about a child, and graduation rates, and said that if they're doing so poorly on SATs, but they're graduating high school, they must be... The high school's diplomas must mean nothing, which, of course, is a total opposite, because we all know that a high school GPA is the best predictor of college success. So his prescription was essentially to order high school exit exams, which, again, have been proven over and over again not only to be ineffective, but to disproportionately affect our neediest children, children with disabilities and ELL children. And then the third ed policy decision he made, which was completely at odds with the evidence, is he insisted that teacher evaluations be linked to test scores, which we all know is irrational, unverifiable. That's what he likes to talk about, is rational and verifiable standards. But we all know that teachers account for 1 to 14% of a student's standardized test score. So, and we all know that rating students by teachers by student test scores has an error rate of, I believe it's something like 30%. It's no better than tossing a coin. So that we know that this is supremely unverifiable and irrational. But this is what he was ordering for teacher evaluation. And then to make matters worse, and maybe, Jonathan, you've written about this, you could talk more about this, but he essentially said, Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong, that we spend too much money on special education. And, you know, if a kid is so disabled that he or she really can't get what he determines is enough out of an elementary school education or high school education, maybe we shouldn't be spending money on him. He's not worth the money.
Exactly. So the idea that, going back to what we just talked about a little earlier, is that our elected officials are falling down on the job. They're not doing what's necessary. So we go to the courts. The courts play an increasingly important role in trying to force the legislative and executive branch to do what's right. But it's a two-edged sword, and there are cases in New York and Pennsylvania and in Kansas, a number of states where the judicial branch has said very clearly the legislative branch is not putting in enough money, needs to put in more money, the executive branch needs to put in more money. And those are cases that are being held out as examples where it required, it took the judicial branch to tell the executive and legislative branch that they needed to do their job. Here, as we noted, it's a mixed bag in a very big way, and this one judge who really proceeded to use his ruling to try to force the state of Connecticut to adopt all of the education reform, corporate education reform initiatives, the proposals that are leading to undermining public education and the privatization of public education and the dependence on standardized tests and the notion that every child is the same and those who can succeed will succeed. Every child can the same in the sense that you could test them, and if they can succeed, they'll succeed, and if they don't score well on the test, then they should fail. And the ultimate being this really unbelievable violating the United States Constitution, his ideas violating federal law, both of which the U.S. Constitution and federal law make it very clear that you can't discriminate against people based on a variety of factors, including their need for special education services, and the state constitution in Connecticut being very clear that you can't discriminate against people. So we're sort of reeling from this test, from this judicial decision, in which after waiting all these years for the judge finally to act, or the judiciary finally to act, we have a judge who took one small step in the positive direction and then a giant step in the wrong direction. But because the mainstream media wants to report very quickly without digging into anything, they were already putting up headlines before this judge read his decision. Word for word his decision. Before he was even done, they were putting up headlines of that it was a courageous move by the judge to condemn Connecticut's education system. He condemned Connecticut's education system, all right. He condemned it to far greater failure than we have if we were to adopt all of the judge's ruling and demand. And so, again, that's why there was such an upheaval that, interestingly, the state side, that is, the people who tried to delay the case from going forward, they're the ones who have appealed it, although the plaintiffs had said, if you appeal, we want these other issues dealt with as well. But now everything is on hold as it goes to the state Supreme Court, and this case will now have, obviously, huge significance across the country, significance mostly or more prominently here in Connecticut, because how the Supreme Court decides it will become the law of the land for Connecticut. But there will be lots of other courts that will look to Connecticut and say, can judges, in essence, rewrite, not only can they tell the legislative branch to spend more money or not spend more money, but can they, from the bench, rewrite all of education policy? And so from the standpoint of what does this mean, there will be now probably far greater numbers of people looking at this case than they otherwise would have, because the judge had such a strange decision in which, as I said, one element was good and a number of elements were terrible.
And to its credit, the state recognized, and you know, the state appealed not the adequacy, because they're very happy with that, but a lot of the ed policy decisions and the unequal distribution of funding decision. But to its credit, the state said that the judge went way beyond his authority, and the kinds of prescriptions he made were not only in the area of special ed probably violate federal law, but also threaten to leave our most vulnerable behind. And I really, you know, to their credit, that's something that I would think that the plaintiffs agree with too.
Wendy, I've asked a question, and you too, Jonathan. If I have it correctly, in those states, many of those states where the state Supreme Court has stepped in and said that the legislature, the governor, has not provided adequate funding, it's unconstitutional what they have done up to this point. And I'm thinking here specifically of New York, mm-hmm. where even though their own state Supreme Court will say, provide more funding, they haven't done it.
Well, I could speak to New York specifically and the other ones, because I worked on that landmark case, the Campaign for Fiscal Equity. What happened was that once they won the case in 2003, they won at trial in 2001, but it went up to the highest court, and you know it had another subsequent appeal on another issue. But in fact, what happened was in 2007, the court did say you're violating the constitutional rights, and there the state and the court ordered that the state issue a remedy just for New York City, because it was the New York City students who were just the plaintiffs, and the court refused to order a statewide remedy. But in 2007, then Governor Spitzer, who was the Attorney General defending this case while it was at trial, he agreed and said, and he enacted massive school funding reform, a new funding formula, And he agreed to pump $5.5 billion in additional funding over 4 years, and that was passed by the legislature. So this case had a dramatic effect in New York. The problem with New York is, so they did have this new funding formula with $5.5 billion in additional funding and over 80% directed to high-needs districts, and they started implementing the phase-in over 2 years, but then the recession hit, and they decided that they were going to cut funding. So it did have an effect, but as what happens in many of these cases is that when either times get tough or the legislature changes or the legislature decides it's too expensive to help children, they backslide, and then plaintiffs have to go back to court. And that certainly happened in New Jersey, that, you know, and it happened in Kansas. And it's happening in Washington State, where the state is steadfastly refusing to obey a court order, and they're being fined $100,000 a day by the Supreme Court of Washington. What is very important to remember is that when states do live up to their obligation, like they did for quite a few years in New Jersey and like they did in Kansas, and they do fund at an adequate level, student performance actually improves. That happened in New Jersey when Abbott was at full funding. The graduation gap between African American men, young boys, and white boys virtually closed. And two very prominent state nationwide studies has shown that, one out of Northwestern and one out of Berkeley, and these are nationwide studies that show that when states actually faithfully enact school funding reform, student achievement and outcomes, life outcomes like employment and other outcomes, actually improve, and it has the most dramatic effect for our poorest children.
A couple points. One, that, Wendy, I was thinking specifically of the Washington State case where the court levied the $100,000 fine mm-hmm. per day, but I was also thinking about New York, as you just mentioned. They funded for the first year or two, and then, boom, it stopped. And that is the pattern. And as you mentioned, when that happens, it basically sends us right back to square one. You have to start all over again, and hence you get these loan delays like you guys just experienced in terms of 11 years to get to the recent court decision when something that was filed back in 05. It's incredible. Second point that I wanted to raise, and you just finished on it, in terms of the relationship between funding and outcome. To me, it goes back to 1965-67 when Johnson declared his war on poverty, when Johnson started the elementary and secondary school at pumping money into education on a huge scale. That was a recognition that there is a one-to-one correspondent relationship between poverty and learning, or poverty and achievement. And he was trying to, quote, narrow the gap by increasing the funding and seeing whether or not the results would be impacted in terms of a one-to-one correlation. We've known this since the mid-60s. That is poverty, stupid, and yet still here we are fighting this same damn issue so many decades later. One last point. Jonathan, mm-hmm. I think you know that I've talked about neoliberalism quite often on this show. I know you were at the United Opt Out conference this past February, and at that conference, I was told many times that many of the educators, teachers, the presenters, and et cetera, were talking about neoliberalism. And before I started talking about it here on the show, there wasn't even mention, let alone a conversation. And what I did earlier when I was reading your stuff, Wendy, and Jonathan, I always read your stuff, I wrote down, basically, folks, what we have here is a neoliberal decision. It's not a law. based upon law. It's a political decision. It's a decision that Wendy, I use a term called, or a phrase basically called the Machiavellian agenda. And the way I have explained it is that the corporate, state, philanthropic, financial, political elite who are behind what I call the war on public education and a much, much larger war with the objective of eventually privatizing everyone and everything, humanity and the planet, and that their plan, their agenda, is so well crafted that Machiavelli could rise up in his grave with a huge smile saying, job well done. And I also talk about how it has been implemented. And my point here is that this decision is straight out of the Machiavellian agenda. One part of the neoliberal ideology is that, quote, American is exceptional in the sense that we are supposedly a nation of law. Well, it is the government, it's the judiciary responsibility in a neoliberal order to fashion laws that support the agenda. And in this case, I see both his primary decision and then him going afield in so many other policy areas was nothing but an attempt to fortify the neoliberal war on public education, which is in game, is the ownership and control of the $1.5 trillion budget, but also educating today's children and future generations in a dumbed-down curriculum that does not support critical thinking, because to maintain their objectives, they don't want people to be able to engage in critical thinking. They want compliance and no deviance.
Well, and that's why the neoliberal New York Times loved it so much, because it really didn't end up doing anything for kids, this decision, but it did blame schools, which they love, and it used the rhetoric of civil rights. So it was like, you know, they always like to use civil rights rhetoric to make it sound like they're doing something for our neediest kids, when in fact the result is our neediest kids would be the worst impacted by this decision. And it has a side benefit of blaming schools and educationalizing problems like they always like to do.
Exactly. Wendy, I've even talked about that, your point, in terms of back in the 90s, when the choice movement that was came out of Milton Friedman's push for choice and then standards, those two separate movements, they talked about human capital. That failed. The public didn't resonate with this notion of their kids and the learning as part of something called social or human capital. They went back, those two movements, I call them 1.0, went back to the drawing board, and they literally looked at the civil rights movement of the 60s and 70s and recast themselves using the language of the civil rights movement, this notion of it's a civil rights right that we have here for high-stakes testing. If we have a civil right, a human right, for the type of reforms that they are pushing. So, yes, even the language coming out of it, I did read most of the decision. Boy, was it a long one. And yeah. You guys have to sit through it for, 3 hours, I think you said earlier?
I only lasted for 2 hours, then I read the rest. I don't understand why he needed to read it word for word, but whatever.
Well, to me, it was the propaganda that he needed to emphasize all the right buzzwords that basically, or call them code words, and if you understand the Enigma code, he was telling his people, I'm delivering what you all want me to deliver. And it sounds beautiful. That's my character.
You're absolutely right. And you have your assessment of the situation and the problem that it places on parents and on teachers and on all of us who care about education is the same problem that all of us who care about democracy, and that is just electing somebody is not enough. You have to then stay engaged and to try to follow what they're doing, because these are our elected officials who refuse to follow the constitution of the country or of the states. They refuse to do what's required of them. Then, as we said, we go to the courts, and sometimes that works, and sometimes that doesn't work. In this case, we have a neoliberal judge who has a neoliberal agenda. In Connecticut, we have a neoliberal governor. In New York, there's a neoliberal governor, both of them as Democrats. Of course, New Jersey has a Republican, Chris Christie, who's been undermining education in that state. In Pennsylvania, for years, there was a Republican governor who was doing damage. Now, finally, a Democratic governor who's doing better.
Who himself is not so great.
Who's not so great.
Well, he's not, you know, he should be, there's a school funding case going on there, and he should be supporting it. And it's, anyway, while he says that school funding is not enough, he doesn't support the case. So, anyway, but go ahead.
It really is right. I mean, you know, it's just such a testament to the importance of getting information. And, of course, the big lesson that we've learned here in Connecticut is not only exactly what you just said about the neoliberal decision, but that the mass media, and one could argue as a principal partner in that neoliberal agenda, really reported
Fourth
something
of state.
That wasn't true.
You remember that?
That's right.
Fourth of state.
That's right.
And I just want to highlight, there's no way
that voters would be able to know unless they were listening to this show or reading Wendy's articles or my articles, because the media refuses to cover what's really happening.
And I just want to pick up on one thing that was really important that Jonathan said, is the importance of that kind of democratic vigilance. I mean, democratic, not party, but the vigilance that democracy requires. Because, you know, while I said that Governor Spitzer passed this law, it would not have been possible, and none of these decisions would not have been translated from the positive decisions from the courts to actual legislation without a public push and organized people pushing for the right thing. So, you know, even when you get a good decision, you still need to exert political pressure to get it passed. And just with regard to the neoliberal effect of this decision, and Jonathan, you know, you could talk a little to this if we have time, is that, you know, the people who were jumping for joy at this decision were the charter lobby, because they think that rational means they can get funding diverted, public funding diverted to charter schools. Now that they can, you know, they've been saying for years it doesn't matter how much money is in our funding formula. It doesn't matter how much money the state gives. It just has to be, quote, rational. And rational to them is giving money from public schools to charter schools. So they have this great opportunity to rework a school funding system. Now, of course, it's been their great opportunity has been sidelined a little by this appeal, and hopefully
right.
It will be appealed. But, you know, they were all excited at this decision because they saw it as a way to get their hooks into public funding.
I got a question from one of the listeners. She wanted to know the four districts that you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show that was involved in a lawsuit, and specifically wanted to know whether or not Danbury was one of the districts.
Yeah, it wasn't only four, but the coalition covered even more than the districts that were at issue in the case. I mean, you know, Stanford, where I live, where, frankly, our governor used to be a lead plaintiff and a founder of the CJF coalition when he was mayor here. That, you know, Stanford was one of the part of the coalition. However, we weren't at issue in the case. Bridgeport, New London, Wyndham, Danbury, East Hartford, New Britain. Was there another one that had? There was testimony at least of to those six, and there might have been more. I'm trying to think.
Was Meriden, East Hartford?
East Hartford. I said I'm not sure if Meriden.
Let me break in. We've got a caller from Connecticut. Are you there, caller?
Hi, this is Jolie from Connecticut calling in. Thank you so much for this show, James, and thank you so much, John and Wendy, for educating us on what is going on, because it is so confusing, not only for teachers, which is, you know, I'm a teacher, I'm a Danbury teacher, but also for parents. And I just want to know, what do we do? How do we now fight back against this judge and this ruling? How do we now protect our most at-risk kids in Connecticut? What can parents do?
I'm going to just talk really briefly with regard to the, I would say keep informed about the appeal, because that's you know, and if you're in Danbury, you know, Danbury was a party to the case. You could really push the Danbury your Board of Ed to make sure that the things we were talking about, you know, that adequacy be a real part of, you know, that first of all you keep informed, but also to make sure that you make that your Board of Ed pushes for all the right things in the appeal, that they push to overturn this, you know, because they're part of the coalition, that they push to overturn the bad ed policy, and they push to overturn the bad adequacy decision. Jonathan?
And we are going to need to do a much better job of informing voters and helping and getting voters to hold elected officials accountable. That really is, unfortunately, the problem here, that these elected officials all send out their campaign brochures saying, I'm pro-education, and yet refuse to do the very things that need to happen. And so getting a governor, getting legislators who will do the right thing, in the end, will be the only way that we will have a profound impact on the quality of public education.
So you have to go to local events when they're running and put the hard questions to them.
Right.
And you have to support Jonathan and his run for Congress.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Jonathan, say something, because I'm giving you my plug.
Okay, thank you. I will take you up on that. So I'm running as a Green Party candidate for Congress this election. 2 years ago, I was a petitioning candidate for governor. What I've learned is that the only time the mainstream media will cover an issue is if a candidate is talking about that issue. And so not only do we need to do a better job of following up and making sure that our legislators are voting the right way, in fact, we need to get people to run for office, because I already see the impact of when you're running, other people then start to pay attention. Elected officials might even start to change their position in order to make sure that they don't lose the election or lose their constituency. In my case, I'm running out in Eastern Connecticut, the 2nd Congressional District. It's a Democratic district, a Democratic congressman, but he was a strong supporter, or is a strong supporter, of the Every Student Succeeds Act, which just continues the No Child Left Behind notion that every child should be tested every year with these punitive exams. So I'm hoping that my candidacy will help change the debate some out here. And what we need is more people being willing to run, more people willing to engage in the political process, and certainly more people voting in an informed way, which is, I admit, very difficult since the mainstream media refuses to cover these issues.
Okay. Joe, last comment. I got about 20 seconds.
I just, you know, am going to do whatever I can to make this court case an issue in my district, and do whatever I can to help the kids.
Okay. All right. First, we have just a few seconds. This has been a great, great show, and that person, Joe Lee, she put this show together. She wanted to do this show. She wanted to get the people that she felt were the best people to talk about it. This was Joe Lee's show, and then she called in. That's the first 2.5 year here.
Yeah, I did.
And guys, I want everybody to come back. We'll do another show, either individually, one-on-one, or we do the same group thing, because this was terrific. Joe, you did a great show. And with that, I have got to get off the air before I get in trouble. Thanks, everyone, and I will try and get us back as soon as possible. As I said, either individually or the same group of four that we had. Thanks, everyone. Have a great Sunday.
You.
See
bye-bye.
You, hear
bye.
You, talk to you
Thanks.
Next week.
Thank
bye
you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.